Kia ora. Welcome to Emmerich's Podcast, episode 253. Today is Thursday, April 21st, 2011. It is Thursday, but it feels like Friday, and we're losing a day. I'll explain that first. Then I will talk a little bit about the weekend we just had, and then the largest part of this episode will be about the upcoming election, because there's a lot to go over. I haven't really had much of a chance in the past couple of weeks, and there's been a lot that's been going on. But first, we are coming into a holiday weekend. It's a four-day weekend in New Zealand, as I've mentioned before. Good Friday and Easter Monday are both public holidays. And in addition, Good Friday and Easter Sunday are both days with trading bans, which means that most businesses can't do anything on those days. Shops are closed, for instance. We don't have commercials on TV either. The other days are Christmas Day and Anzac Day morning, which, well, up until 1 p.m. However, this year, Anzac Day falls on Monday. Easter Monday, I should say. So that means that we lose a public holiday. And this is in a year where we already lost one because Waitangi Day was also on a weekend. Now, Anzac Day is very specific because it commemorates a particular event, an event that in many ways shaped the nations of both New Zealand and Australia. And I don't think that Mondayizing it would be a very good idea. Waitangi Day, that's another matter. It doesn't have a whole lot of significance to most New Zealanders. I mean, they know what it is, but it's not like the U.S. where Independence Day has all sorts of outpourings of patriotism and parades and stuff like that, or even like Australia Day in Australia. New Zealanders just aren't that ostentatiously patriotic as Australia or the U.S. is, and it just seems a bit silly to force people to observe the day on the actual date when it doesn't really have any significance for them in that way. It's just a day off work in the summer, and I think it should be Mondayized. Anzac Day, not so sure about that one. But, of course, this year it is on Easter Monday, as I said, and there was a poll that was conducted, and I've forgotten who it was. I didn't save the link or anything, but it was a silly poll because it found that, this will shock you, that Anzac Day has more meaning to people than Easter Monday. No! I shouldn't make fun of that, but I just thought that was the biggest duh I'd seen in a public opinion poll in ages, because Easter Monday has no significance whatsoever apart from being the day off after Easter Sunday, and in a secular country like New Zealand, even Easter doesn't have all that much significance, and so the fact that Anzac Day has more significance for New Zealanders than Easter Monday is one of the most blatantly obvious things I would have thought. I don't understand why they did a poll about it, but they did. It was somehow related to travel, which was even more bizarre. What that has to do with travel, I don't know. They're talking about people going away for the holiday weekend, I think. And it is a big deal. We're also in the school holidays, in the middle of the school holidays. And so there will be a lot of people who will be going away for the weekend, which in a roundabout way kind of brings me to the topic of our last weekend, because we went to a wedding in Whirianga in the Coromandel Peninsula, in the eastern side of the peninsula. And because Coromandel is where a lot of people from Auckland go to holiday. They very often have holiday homes in the Coromandel. The Coromandel is unusual in that the vast majority of properties are owned by non-residents. That means that, you know, the sections where people have their houses or whatever, they don't live there year-round. They still pay taxes, of course, or what we call rates, but they don't actually live there. And in most areas in the country, the properties are owned by people who actually live there. And so they're quite unusual in that regard. But Whirianga is on the eastern side of the peninsula. Up, it's about two-thirds of the way up on the eastern side. And I had been directly opposite, well, not directly opposite, but on the opposite side of the peninsula, the western side, to Coromandel Town. I've been there, well, it's once, I guess, but I have been there, but never that far north in the east. I've only been as far north as Whangamata, which is in the lower third of the eastern side. And the reason is that it's very difficult to get to. The easiest way to get there from Auckland is to go up this thing that's called the Kopuhikawai Road. And when you're heading off to Whirianga, it rises through the ranges and then goes over the top and then goes back down the other side to get to Whirianga. And it is a hellish road. It twists, it turns, it rises, it falls. There's sharp bends, there are blind corners. It's an awful road. And It's legendary for making kids carsick, and I can see why. I think when I was a kid, I would have gotten carsick on that road too. It's not a road where you can go the whole speed limit, and it's one of the reasons why it takes so long. It only takes about an hour and some, I don't know, maybe an hour and 15, hour and a half. I don't really know. I didn't time it. But it feels like it's hours and hours because it's such an awful road. I was joking that if it was in America, that we just would have pushed over the mountains and filled in the valleys and made the road straight. And I was only half joking because there was a time Americans would have done that. But be that as it may, the roads certainly could use improvement to make it easier to get to. But on the other hand, if they did, then more people would go there and it might lose some of its charm. I understand, though, that that road, awful as it is a bumper-to-bumper car park in the summer, particularly around, say, Boxing Day or thereabouts, somewhere around Christmas, New Year's, when all the Aucklanders are trying to get to their holiday homes or what have you. But Whitianga is a lovely spot. It's a lovely part of the country. Unfortunately, the wedding was actually held on Saturday, and it was a blustery, rainy day that day. It was supposed to be held on the beach, and the last minute it was moved to a venue nearby, which was somewhat drier because of the winds. The rain was being driven in. We were in a covered area, but not inside. But the reception itself was in a hall in Whitianga, so that was fine. That didn't have any problems. Of course, the rain ended by then, I think. But apart from that, it was a nice ceremony and all that sort of thing. But the next day was bright and sunny, and so I went and stopped and took a few photos, which I've put on my blog, and I posted a few to my Flickr account as well. It is a really lovely part of the country, and we're going to go further north, but probably on the other side of the peninsula up to Colville or something, just so that I can see more of that particular part of New Zealand. It's one of the most, not rustic exactly, but one of the most unspoiled parts of the country that's close to Auckland. I think that's fair to say. Parts of the west coast in West Auckland are similarly wild in the Waitakere Ranges, but it's different, and it's actually a lot of that is completely undeveloped. So, you know, some of that area you can't actually get to very easily. But I haven't been there either, actually. I've never been to Mirawai or to Piha, and that is also on the agenda, but I think it might wait till summer now because the temperatures are starting to drop. But it was a lovely weekend, all things considered. One of Nigel's sisters had rented a house for us to stay in, and it was an old, I think it's called bungalow style, which had been done up at some stage with polished floors and all that. And it was really quite nice. It was a nice house. And we all had a good time. I wasn't hungover either Friday or Saturday. Thank you very much. And so it was a good time. And on the way back to Auckland, we stopped at a farmer's market in some town. I don't remember what the town was called, but it's north of Tairua. I think they have it every Sunday. I'm not sure at any rate. But being in the middle of nowhere, they didn't have any UFPOS. It was cash only. And of course, I never have cash. So it wasn't like I was going to be able to actually buy anything. But they had a lot of organic produce. In fact, all the produce was organic, I believe. And then they had free-range pork and things like that available for sale. Now, the thing you need to know about Coromandel is that it is legendary as a refuge for ex-hippies. And by ex-hippies, I really mean people who have kind of not left their hippiedom. They might still be wearing their Birkenstock sandals and shorts and tie-dye t-shirts, but they've got their long hair is now gray and pulled back in a ponytail, thinning on the top probably. Okay, I'm being a little unfair. That's not entirely true. A lot of the people there are actually people who've moved to the region for lifestyle reasons. They probably aren't even old enough to be hippies. I mean, real hippies, although I'm told that hippiedom, if you want to call it that, stayed in New Zealand longer than it did in the U.S., with communes and all those sorts of things still quite in existence here well into the 70s and I think even into the 80s in some areas. But at any rate, the Coromandel, because so much of it is undeveloped, is the sort of place where people go for what can legitimately be called alternative lifestyles. They have self-sufficient homesteads, basically, where they have, maybe they make their own power or maybe they have no power. They raise their organic vegetables. They might engage in some sort of craft where they sell it, things like that, the farmer's market. And it's a completely different way of life. And I'm not saying it's good or bad. It's just different. And it's interesting, I think. But what I also noticed were the large number of foreign accents at this farmer's market, you know, among the people selling, people milling around to buying. Heard a couple of Americans, English, of course, German, all sorts of different types of accents there. And it is the kind of place you move to get away from normal civilization. And when I say normal, I'm basically meaning urban, even small town, really, because a lot of the Carmandal is really rural. And so that's the sort of place these people like to go. And, of course, it is notorious as well as a region where a lot of marijuana has been grown. And periodically there are busts about that because, of course, it is illegal to have marijuana, not that the police do a whole lot with a person growing a plant for their own use. If they find it, of course, they'll deal to it and they'll prosecute the person who has it. But they don't go out of their way looking for it. They're interested more in the, you know, the farms and things, which I think is stupid, but that's a topic for another day. So that's what the region is like. And so Carmandal is primarily two things. Tourism, or people serving the tourists, motels, hotels, cafes, whatnot, or people who have moved to the Carmandal for lifestyle reasons, like ex-hippies or hippie wannabes or what have you, but not exclusively, because there's also, you know, just organic farmers or what have you, or craftspeople, artists. And so it's a really interesting kind of place. It is the only electorate in the country that has ever elected a Green Party member as an MP. The others have always been, and still are, list candidates. And that brings me to my next topic, which is the election update. Election Watch 2011.
Mr. Speaker!
It's probably why the Leader of the Opposition wants the government to resign to have a snap election, because he's confused between our polling numbers and their polling numbers, actually.
The New Zealand that I believe in and that Labour will deliver is one where everyone pulls their weight, everyone pays their fair share, and in return, everyone gets a fair go.
The true test of an economy is the well-being of our land, our water, and our people.
Right. Well, I thought I would let that whole thing play out, and I'm not going to use that long version in future. I just wanted to give you an idea of what the various leaders sound like. The first person speaking, of course, was the Prime Minister, John Key. The second was the Leader of the Opposition, the head of Labour Party, Phil Goff. And the third was the co-leader of the Green Party, Russell Norman. And the reason I didn't use any of the other parties is because they may or may not be in Parliament, but those three will be after the election. That much I am certain. And I actually also thought that those clips kind of showed a bit of the respective attitudes of the various parties. The clip from John Key in particular was edited from a time when he was being particularly snarky in Parliament. He got told off by the Speaker 3 days in a row for making snarky remarks like that. And I don't think he did himself or his party any favors, even though that sort of snarkiness is par for the course during question time, which is where that comes from. But it, I think, was a bit inappropriate. Be that as it may, I want to set the stage for you to give you some idea of what the, I don't know, landscape is heading into this election. And I originally prepared this for a blog post that I haven't yet done. And so it may show up on my blog in a different form. But here's New Zealand by the numbers. $2.18.9, which is the average price per liter of petrol in Auckland. And on the day that I calculated that I did this, the conversion was approximately $6.58 US per US gallon. 4.5% annual inflation rate. 1.7% the annual wage increase for New Zealand workers, all sectors. 6.8% New Zealand unemployment rate in the December 2010 quarter. So New Zealanders are paying the highest prices for petrol in 3 years, which has led the annual inflation rate to rise to 4.5%. But average annual wage increases have risen only 1.7% for those who have jobs, of course, because the unemployment rate in New Zealand rose to 6.8%. The National Party touts its economic credentials and it's good management of the economy. Yet 60% of New Zealand households got no net gain from their tax changes. Nothing. But the top 1% of earners got an average of $16,000 per year in tax cuts. And of course, this government raised GST, which affects the ordinary people far more intensely than it does the rich. They cut the taxes for the rich and for corporations, and they gave virtually no tax cuts to the middle and average income people, partly because they increased GST, but also because they eliminated early childhood education grants, which means that working families have seen their child care bills skyrocket. And the list goes on and on and on. Now, when they came into power, the National Party promised that they were going to reduce the income gap between New Zealanders and Australians. Essentially, we are paid substantially less for doing the same jobs as Australians. It turns out that that hasn't happened. And wages in New Zealand are about 30% lower than in Australia. And Bill English, who's the finance minister and deputy prime minister, said that that means that New Zealand has a competitive advantage. Well, no finance minister in his right mind would tout the advantages of being a low-wage economy as if that's a good thing. And of course, basically, they were admitting that they failed when they tried to close the wage gap. And when you look at these statistics, you would think to yourself that since the average New Zealander is worse off now than when National came to power in 2008, that they would be clamoring for change and that the prospect for Labor to regain government should be really, really good. If you thought that, you'd probably be wrong, because TV3 News, together with Reed Research, did a poll and found that National support was actually up 2.9 percentage points to 57.5%, which is not far from their highest, which is 60% a couple of years ago. Labor, on the other hand, was down 3.8% to 27.1%. The Greens were also down half a point to 7.7%, which is big for them because half a percentage point when they're only at 7.7 is big. But they're the only other party who's polling above 5%, and I'll come back to that in a minute. But despite everything that is going wrong for this government and for New Zealand, Labor is falling in the polls and National is rising in the polls, so much so that if the election were held now on the basis of that poll, National would govern alone. It wouldn't need any other parties to form government. And although there's nothing new in that, obviously, because before MMP came along, governments almost always governed alone. And so that's not particularly unusual, except when you consider the agenda of National, which is to sell off everything that's not nailed down, pretty much. They want to sell off state-owned assets, Air New Zealand, Television New Zealand, the ports, the airports, ports, anything basically that the public own. They want to sell Kiwi Bank, all of that stuff, New Zealand Rail, which is called Kiwi Rail now. And ordinary New Zealanders don't want those assets sold. And yet National's already said they will start selling things off once if they win re-election. So why is Labor doing so poorly? Well, the main reason, of course, is that they are absolutely hapless and hopeless, perhaps. I already talked about the Darren Hughes saga, and that was all over the news. And it's not so much that it made the party look bad, although it probably did. And it's not so much that it made Phil Goff look bad, the leader of the party, although it did. It's more that it was negative news and constantly in the news. And the media, particularly the New Zealand Herald, which is a right-wing newspaper, the biggest newspaper in the country, was able to paint Goff in particular as a ditherer and that he should have acted sooner. He wasn't up front enough and blah, 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 blah. They were able to spin it their way. National, of course, was saying nothing during this whole time. And so because they didn't say anything either way, they weren't tarred with any sort of brush whatsoever. You know, they didn't come across as being mean-spirited or as being anything. So they did themselves no harm during that whole saga. Well, that was just finally ending. Labor was off the front pages for those reasons. And then one of their own sticks the boot in. There's a List MP by the name of Damien O'Connor, and he was the MP for West Coast Tasman, which is the electorate that's on the west coast of the South Island. It includes Greymouth the site of the Pike River Mine. It also includes Blackball, which was where the Labour Party was founded. And he lost the seat in 2008 when National came to power. He's now a list candidate. Now, before I go any further, I have to explain first what this is all about. Under MMP, our electoral system, we have two kinds of MPs. We have MPs who are called electorate MPs, and they are elected from a geographic district, what the U.S. would call a congressional district, what Canada calls ridings, those sorts of things. They're actual districts. They have geographic boundaries, and you know who's there and all that sort of stuff. But the other part of Parliament is made up of what are called list candidates. And the way it works is that each party draws up a list of people to who they would elect, who they would bring into Parliament if everybody got in. And typically they are both people who are, you have people who are running as electorate MPs and as list candidates. Now, in some cases, they're on the list and they're ranked highly because they're important, like, say, the leader of the party, the deputy leader, and so on. Other times, so it's sort of like a reward for being so good, I don't know. Other times, they are on the list because they either can't or don't want to run for an electorate. One of Labour's most effective MPs is a man by the name of Charles Chevelle, who at the moment is a list candidate, and I don't believe he ran in an electorate in 2008. I can't remember, but I think he is this year. But for years, Michael Cullen, who was the deputy prime minister and the finance minister in the last Labour government, was a list candidate. He was not an electorate MP. Didn't run in any electorate, whereas Helen Clark, the prime minister, did. She was MP for Mount Albert. So you see this sort of thing handled different ways by different parties. Now, there are controversies about MMP and about how the list works, and I'll talk about that another time because that's also on the ballot in this election. But for the purposes of this discussion, what's important to know is that the list is a ranking of candidates. The higher you are on the list, the more likely you are to get in Parliament if you don't win in an electorate. If you're too low on the list, it means that if the party doesn't do well, that you won't get in. And on that poll that I mentioned a little while ago, there are some sitting Labour MPs, who are list candidates, who would not be in the new Parliament, including one named Stuart Nash, who is the grandson, I think it is, of Walter Nash, a former Prime Minister, and by all reports, a competent member of Parliament. He would be out based on this polling, as would several other MPs who are on the list only. Now, the drawing up the list varies from party to party. I have no idea how National draws up their list. Maybe it's a bunch of guys with fat cigars who sit in a room and draw it up. I don't know. I've got no idea. Labour does it through its caucus primarily, the people who are in Parliament, together with the party officials and so on, and they trade horses and come up with the listing that people can live with, various constituency groups within the party. The Greens do it completely differently. They send it out to their membership and ask their members to rank the people however they think they should be. And although, as I understand it, the leadership of the party, which is some sort of executive of some sort, I don't know how the committee structure works, can sort of tweak it at the last minute to, you know, achieve geographic balance and those sorts of things. Although I could be a bit wrong about that. But the point is that they consult their party members about what their list should be. And as far as I know, it's the only party that does that in New Zealand. So the drawing up a list can be contentious if you're not ranked as highly as you think you should be. And that's what happened with Damien O'Connor. He apparently somehow found out, and I don't know how, that he wasn't ranked very highly on the party list. And so he sort of spat the dummy. He took his toys and went home and said he would only run as an electorate MP, which is fair enough. That's certainly his right to do that. But this sort of thing is what gets talked about behind closed doors in the caucus. You don't go to the media and start talking about how unhappy you are that you didn't get your way. He did. He said that the list was drawn up by self-serving unionists and a gaggle of gays. This did not go over well with anybody, pretty much. The problem is that what's the name of the party? It's the Labour Party. So, of course, there are unionists or ex-unionists who are ranked highly on the list. But as it happens, there are only, I think, two or three people who come from the trade union movement who are ranked highly. There are plenty of others who have been a labor union member at one time or another, but that's hardly the same thing. As for gays, there are three who are ranked highly. There is a fourth who is ranked really pretty low and is probably unlikely to get into parliament. And then there is a fifth who is running only as an electorate candidate. She's not on the list at all. And so there's five out of 70 people. Well, actually, there's only four out of 70 people on the list, because there's 70 ranked, who are gay or lesbian. No transgender this time. And so that, you know, that's hardly exerting a hell of a lot of influence. And as it happens, the three gay MPs who are ranked highly, Charles Chevelle, Grant Robertson, who is also an electorate MP, and Marianne Street, are all considered to be highly effective members of Parliament. So what the hell is his problem, except that he is disgruntled about not getting what he thought he deserved? And Damien O'Connor is a redneck, by all accounts. He is a redneck. And unfortunately, that was the angle that got played up a lot in the media, with commentators saying that, essentially implying that all West Coast voters are rednecks and they wouldn't like unionists and gays anyway, which I thought was an unfair slam against the people of the West Coast, because there are plenty of people who clearly aren't rednecks. They, more often than not, have elected a Labor Party member to be their MP. So, you know, they can't be too redneck, can they? If they were, they would always elect a National Party person, and they don't. So I thought that was stupid. But Phil Goff didn't help matters any, because he said that O'Connor's comments would help win him some votes on the West Coast, you know, playing into this myth of the homophobic, racist West Coaster. And he didn't do himself any favors. He didn't do the party any favors, because he got the ire of the party base when he did that, because he was slagging off at some of the most loyal constituencies of the Labor Party, unionists and gay people. And for no good reason. Now, as it happens, both O'Connor and Goff are from the conservative wing of the Labor Party, and they don't really care too much about the left wing of the Labor Party, which includes the Rainbow Caucus, as it's called, and unionists in particular. And so it was not a good look. So it started talk of a leadership challenge. Then when the poll came out, there's more talk of a leadership challenge. And quite frankly, I'm not surprised, because Phil Goff hasn't done a whole lot to win over people. He is polling at 6.8% in the preferred prime minister stake, whereas John Key, I think, is above 50. Here it is. He's at 52.4%. And now that oven by itself is a little misleading, because whoever is prime minister always polls highly as preferred prime minister. But it is very unusual for the leader of the opposition to be in single digits, basically, at this, especially only 7 months out from the election. So Phil Goff is not very popular. And I saw somewhere, and I don't have a link for this anywhere, but I saw somewhere a report that 30% of Labour voters don't want Phil Goff as the leader, which suggests he's in quite a lot of trouble. But then so is Labour. So this is why, if you take all of this together, the constant turmoil that Labour has been going through with its caucus, the dissatisfaction with Goff as leader of the party, this is really why National is riding so high in the polls, despite how bad things are going, and why Labour is foundering, I think it is the correct word. Because they are just hapless and hopeless. Now, I talked last time about the copyright bill, and that's another thing that got the base riled up, because there was a certain arrogance among some of the Labour caucus members. I was reading on Red Alert. I thought Claire Curran was awfully condescending in her defense of Labour's position. What she was saying, and I talked about this before, was that that Labour's support for the bill meant that they could water down their provisions on disconnection. And you can make that argument, but the worst parts of the bill are not actually that. It's the fact that you're guilty until proven innocent and all those sorts of things. And those weren't changed at all. And I just think it's a bit dishonest for Labor to be trying to portray that as some great victory. At the best, they could say, well, we tried to make a bit of lemonade and leave it at that, and then pledge to repeal it once they get into government. They're not pledging to repeal it, which is a concern. The only party which has spoken strongly against that bill is the Green Party, who I'm liking more and more, I have to say. But that, too, is a topic for another day, because they haven't been in the news so much lately, apart from the fact that one of their MPs, who was actually, their newest MP, certainly the youngest in their caucus, by the name of Gareth Hughes. That's Gareth Hughes. The first time I heard his name called out in Parliament, I thought they said Darren Hughes. I thought, wait a minute, he just left. But anyway, he had a spirited and strong speech in Parliament against the copyright bill, and he instantly became a hero to a lot of lefty types because of that. I'm following him on Twitter now, and he doesn't stray far from the Green Party line, which is what you would expect of any MP, really. But he also hasn't said anything that makes me think, wow. Actually, come to think of it, I don't think any of the MPs I follow have made me do that. So maybe that's not so unusual. So where we stand now is that National is riding high in the polls. They can't seem to do anything wrong. John Key is immensely popular, personally. Again, he can't do anything wrong. Labor can't seem to do anything right. Nobody likes Phil Goff. And it looks like we're heading toward a major defeat for Labor in November. Now, of course, we're 7 months out from the election. Anything can happen between now and then. But it is difficult to see how Labor can turn that around completely and win the election. The best I think they can hope for is to not lose as badly as it looks right now. And I say that as a center-left voter and someone who's always voted for Labor. So if I'm this disgruntled, you can imagine how much the more firebrandy types must be right now. And it's really a shame. But then, every once in a while, a controversy comes out that presents itself, and you think to yourself, there might be some legs to this. The prime minister went to Hamilton to opened the V8 races there or something. And arguably that was a legitimate thing for him to do because it's a tourism opportunity. However, that night he had to be in Auckland to attend a black tie dinner at a golf club. Now, the reason he was there is because the Auckland Golf Club has just been designated the Royal Auckland Golf Club, which means it's a state occasion, basically, because the Queen is conferring the title. You can't call yourself royal unless you get a warrant from the Queen. And so he had to be back for that. Now, the date of the V8 thing was known for ages and for over a year. And I presume that the date of the dinner was known for quite a while as well. So you think he could have adjusted his schedule somewhat. Well, what he ended up doing was taking an Air Force helicopter from Auckland to Hamilton to attend this event, and the helicopter back, because they were concerned the traffic might be heavy and he might be late for the dinner. Now, of course, most normal people would roll their eyes at that, except that part of the issue, this is their defense, was that the Governor General, who is the Queen's representative, was attending this dinner, and protocol is that no one can arrive after the Governor General. Now, I'll be honest, I don't give a flying rat's ass about royal protocol. I think it's archaic, it doesn't have any place in the 21st century, and if the Governor General has a problem with that, too bad. I mean, I don't see the point of kowtowing to somebody who has their position by an accident of birth, not because they were chosen. But that's my personal opinion. Putting that aside, even if you buy into the argument that you have to bow down before the protocol and you must... follow the protocol and all this sort of stuff, that there is no alternative but to do that. With more than a year to plan this, don't you think they could have arranged the schedule so that he could have taken a normal car back to Auckland? It costs, apparently, something like $900 an hour to fly those Air Force helicopters. Why did he need to do that? With that much time to plan it, they could have done so. Now, the reason why this stings so much for the average New Zealander is that the day before, he had said to the Herald, well, there's nothing the government can do about high prices. We know people are suffering, but sorry, there's nothing we can do about it. I don't know if you can hear that in the background, but there's an Air Force plane that's flying overhead right now. Oh, maybe they heard me. No, it's not their fault. And then today, the Herald revealed that this government has increased their use of Air Force aircraft to get here and there by 50% in the past year. Now, I think what that's about is there was this huge controversy about MPs using travel perks to fly around, mostly overseas. But, you know, there's a rule in politics that you have, whenever you do anything, you have to ask yourself, how would this look on the front page of the Herald? Because the Herald spins the news. And there was this thought that I'm projecting here. I don't know this, but I can imagine people in the National Party caucus saying, we don't want to have flight bills or whatever going through Parliament because people find out about that. And they'll, even though it's legitimate travel, there'll be questions raised and we don't want that in election year. Let's just use the Air Force instead. Now, I don't know that that's what really happened. There could have been any number of reasons why they used these expensive Air Force planes instead of normal public, air transport. But that's certainly a plausible explanation. So that doesn't look good. But I bet you that this story will be dead in a day, maybe two, partly because we're coming into a holiday weekend. And, you know, nobody's going to remember it by Tuesday. But it's the sort of thing that could still come up and bring down National and John Key in the polls. So I do think that regardless of the efforts or non-efforts of Labour and Gough, I do think that the actual election will be much closer than that poll indicates. I have seen nothing yet to indicate to me that that's really how it's going to play out. Labour has just launched its pretty much the centerpiece of its campaign, which is a stop asset sales campaign. And they think that they're going to get a lot of mileage with that. And as I said earlier, ordinary New Zealanders don't want the public assets sold off. The question is, when they are suffering high petrol prices, high food prices, because the food price has been skyrocketing the past couple of years, skyrocketing electric charges, stagnant wages, if you're lucky to have a job even, are they really going to care about asset sales when there are things that are far closer to home that they have to contend with? And that's what I just don't know. I mean, well, nobody does, obviously, but I'm a bit skeptical that that campaign alone is going to be enough to win over average New Zealanders. But I suppose we'll tell in time. I don't know. It's too early to tell, obviously. But the trend is not favorable, I would say. And there are a lot of people who are saying that Phil Gough is going to be safe until the election because the people who want to be leader realize that they don't stand a chance of winning this next election, and they're going to let him take the fall so that they can replace him and not have the baggage of having lost an election. I don't know. That's what they say. It's certainly the sort of thing that parties do, you know, the caucus of a party will do. But John Key himself, I personally think, is not going to see out the next term regardless. He seems bored and detached a lot of the time. He spends most of his time just doing photo ops. And I really think he's going to step down if National gets reelected. And of course, that means who then would become prime minister? It could be Bill English, who's one of the most hated men in New Zealand. He led the National Party to its biggest electoral defeat ever, I believe, in 2002. Certainly one of its worst. So I don't see him as being able to successfully lead the country. But then, too, if they are governing alone, it won't matter what anybody else thinks because he'll have the support of his own caucus. So, yeah, it's going to make for an interesting couple of years, probably, assuming that they are reelected. So that was an extended election update. I will be having more in the future, probably not usually that long or even necessarily very often because, you know, at this point, we're still quite a ways out and I don't know how much is going to happen. But now I'm going to go on to the messages, starting first with a voicemail message.
Hello? Get off my phone! Get off my phone, you little pinhead! Get off my phone! I'm going to lose my mind today!
We're sorry, the number you have dialed is not in service at this time.
Hey, Arthur. It's Kyle in Hawaii. Calling to say hey. Say hi to Nigel and the rest of the family. I definitely agree with your observation that seems to be even America is a conservative party. Even with the advent of log cabin Republicans, and I don't even mention Go Proud, but even then, there's sort of this your conservative individuals hiding and doing sleazy things, especially in the LGBT community, closeted LGBT community. Because, you know, it's sort of the mentality of conservatives and sort of a not in my backyard or don't ask, don't tell that just runs true through their party morals. Anyway, I don't know. Love the podcast. Talk to you later. Bye.
Well, thanks for that, Kyle. And Kyle's such a sweetie. Thank you for the call. Yeah, the whole issue of closeted politicians is one unto itself. There are several politicians who have been rumored to be gay here in New Zealand who were never out or outed. There isn't much of a culture of outing politicians here either, partly because we don't really have the kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? I don't know, we don't have the kind of rabidly anti-gay stuff that the U.S. Republican Party has. So there isn't the need, perhaps, to out politicians. So we don't have that. And most of the politicians, the fact of the matter is, well, first of all, New Zealanders don't really want to know what the politicians are doing behind closed doors or with whom. And even if they did find out, for the most part, it'd be a big shrug. Most New Zealanders just don't care about that sort of thing. And the few who do are statistically insignificant anyway. So it's why it's just not a big deal here. In the case of Darren Hughes, of course, he was from the Labour Party, which bills itself as a centre-left party. I would say centrist party. It's pretty it's a bit like the Democrats in the U.S. They're pretty disdainful of the people who actually are on the left. And although arguably the Democratic Party in the U.S. is less disdainful of its liberal base than it used to be, certainly since the election with the decimation of the Blue Dog Caucus in the U.S. House of Representatives. But be that as it may. So, yeah, there's no reason why Darren couldn't have come out if, in fact, he is gay. As I was suggesting at the time, I think this is going to be an issue that I'll talk about in more detail once all the stories are out, once everything's out. And actually, I don't think I've ever said that over in this podcast, but I know I have over in Too Political. And that's that. This is just a little aside. It's nothing to do with much of anything, really. But if you're talking about traditional Republican values, this is before the Tea Party and all that nonsense came along. Traditional Republican values, the stuff that I believed in when I was a Republican and that many countless others used to believe in before the radical right took over, there is no more Republican cause than gay rights, because what it is really about is the right of the individual adult to make their own choices in life and to be left alone by the government. There is no more Republican cause than that. And the fact that it is no longer a Republican cause shows you how far the party has fallen in the past 30 years. It actually started, and I said this on Too Political as well, it started with the election of Ronald Reagan. It's been all downhill from there. But anyway, that's a topic for the other podcast. Now I'm going over to the site, and I have a written comment from Roger Green, who said, "When you talked about your hand being almost unrecognizable to you, it reminded me about how I view the back of my own hands and parts of my arms, legs, feet, face, vitiligo. Who the hell is that?" He goes on. "That word is very hard for me to pronounce. I had to look it up online, Merriam-Webster.com or whatever the heck it is. And they're two different pronunciations, but I have so much trouble saying it. And I think the reason is because I've actually never seen it or heard it said. I've only seen it in writing many times, but I haven't actually heard anybody use it in speech. And so I've never had the opportunity to learn it. But having said that, there are plenty of other words I can't say too. Like statistically is very difficult for me to say, and it didn't used to be, so I don't know what that's about. But yes, it's the one joint in my finger that is, it's actually still looking pretty unusual to me. But the thing, funny thing about hands, this probably tells you more than you want to know, but when I was in high school, I got a copy of Death Be Not Proud by, what's his name, John Gunther, I think it is. And I never read the whole thing. It's a short book, but I never read it, which is not unusual for me. But I never read that book. But the thing that stuck out in my mind and does to this day is the very first part of the book, the author is talking about his son's hands. And it goes on and on and on about the hands, which is, anyway, I was going to compare it to another book, but I'm not going to go there. And I never paid much attention to hands until that point. And it's not like, and there's nothing kinky here, so don't get all weird. But that's when I actually started paying attention to my own hands. And I remember at the time that, I mean, most people, especially when you're a teenager, you compare yourself to other teens to see, you know, how you measure up. And some of the boys had these blood vessels that were sticking up in the back of their hands. And I didn't at that point. I still had kind of puffy hands. And I remember thinking at the time that that their hands looked so much more grown up than mine did because of that. Well, now I've got that, but I've also got dryness and I've got this funny knuckle down. Oh, my goodness me. But the whole bit about looking in the mirror and saying, who the hell is that? I think it's sort of typical to a lot of people, especially as they get older. That happens to me all the time now, especially after my shower. I look in the mirror and go, who the hell is that? I swear, all of a sudden, I woke up one morning and I was suddenly 20 years older. I swear that 20 years has disappeared and I don't know where it went. Maybe I left it somewhere. Maybe it's in a drawer. I don't know, but they're just gone. And I don't know what could have happened. But that is it for today, and that is it for this week. We got back to the house on Sunday, and I did think, and Nigel was home on Monday, but he also came down with a bad cold, and so he was kind of laying low, and he also couldn't talk very well. It was very raspy. And so obviously I didn't record with him on Monday, and I just didn't get around to recording before today. And I won't be doing any more this week. However, Monday is a holiday. It's a double holiday, of course, because we're missing a holiday this year. And so it's entirely possible we may record on Monday. And, or we may not, you never know. And, of course, his show is also scheduled for Sunday, if he can get onto the server. And assuming that he can, I think that's a show you may want to catch if he can. It is at 9 p.m. Saturday Eastern Daylight Time, which is 1 p.m. Sunday here in New Zealand. And your time zone will vary. I didn't have time to look them all up. And that one's probably worth catching. And I'm actually going to play his promo at the very, very end after my outro, just because I haven't played it in a while. And so if you don't want to hear it, you can stop when you hear the outro. But that is it for this week. I will be back next week. Perhaps with Nigel, maybe not. We shall see. That's it. Have a great weekend, everybody. Bye.
You can leave a comment on this or any other episode of the Amrens Podcast at amrenspodcast.com. You can send an email to me at Arthur, that's A-R-T-H-U-R, at amrenspodcast.com, or you can ring my U.S. comment line on 206-666-5172. This podcast is produced and distributed under Creative Commons license. Complete details at the website.
Hi, this is Nigel. Join me for music, chat and more on The Third Colony this Saturday at 9 p.m. Eastern on QNation.fm. Go to The Third Colony, all one word, thethirdcolony.com for listening instructions and to join the chat room. See you on Saturday at 9 p.m.